Hello, and welcome to our ILD podcast entitled Lung Story Short, Short Takes on ILD. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Shalman. I'm a lung doctor at National Jewish Health, and with me is my esteemed colleague, Dr. Jeff Swigish. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Josh. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for joining. In a way of background, this is the first podcast in a series of podcasts where we're going to cover interstitial lung disease. Our intent is to cover the basics for people who aren't familiar with this, but also take a deeper dive on some of these hot topics that keep us up at night that really excite us in ILD. But this first one will be an ILD 101. And so what Jeff and I want to do is kind of discuss ILD for general practitioners or those who don't see a lot of these patients and kind of give you a framework on how we see these patients and how we diagnose and manage them. So let's get started. I know that interstitial lung disease is complicated. We have a lot of acronyms. It's a hard field to grasp, especially when you don't see these patients on a regular basis. So Jeff, we can start at the beginning. How do you define interstitial lung disease?
Well, I think, Josh, what we ought to do is explain to the audience how we as interstitial lung disease docs think about the lungs. And we think about the lungs in compartments. Right? So there's the airways compartment, there's the vascular compartment, there's the parenchymal compartment, the pleura, and the muscles. So the interstitium, the way that we think about it, there's really a couple of places within the lung that make up the interstitium. First is within alveolar walls, right? So normally there isn't much between the inner wall of the alveolus, the alveolar epithelium, and call it the outer wall or where the capillaries reside. In between those two structures, there's not much, but that's the interstitium. There's a few cells, a little bit of extracellular matrix. And when there's either inflammation or fibrosis or a combination of those two things in that area, that's one place where interstitial lung disease develops. Another is immediately beneath the pleura at the microscopic level. Another one would be along bronchovascular bundles. And as a reminder, the airways and the blood vessels, the arteries and arterioles travel together through the lungs as they branch and get smaller and smaller and smaller. But within those bundles of airway and artery is another space. And then the final space is, if we think about the smallest units of lung that are completely surrounded by connective tissue, the so-called secondary pulmonary lobule, there are septae between those little structures. They're about a centimeter to a centimeter and a half cubed. They are completely surrounded by connective tissue, and within that connective tissue layer is veins and lymphatics. There shouldn't be inflammation or collagen fibrosis in those areas. So subpleural, along bronchovascular bundles, within interlobular septae, and within walls of alveoli are where the interstitium is. And if there's inflammation or fibrosis in there, we call it interstitial lung disease.
Great background. And to stress one of your points, in those areas, we can see inflammation or fibrosis or a combination. We spent a lot of time discussing, is this an inflammatory lung disease? Is it fibrotic? Because it matters. It matters in terms of how patients do over time, and it matters in terms of what we give them. We can talk more about that later when we kind of briefly cover treatments, but interstitial lung disease has to involve those compartments. It can also involve other things, and it often does. And so at a minimum, to say it's interstitial lung disease, we say it has to have some degree of inflammation or fibrosis in these various compartments of the interstitium. But it can involve the airways, which it often does in things like hypersensitivity pneumonitis. It can involve the pleura. It can involve the vasculature. So we often see not only interstitium, but other compartments involved. So that's a great background.
Yeah, you're right, Josh. And we'll get to that point. But depending on what other areas of the lung are involved, you mentioned the airways, the vasculature, or the pleura, that gets us thinking about different etiologies as well. So we want to know, is it primarily inflammatory, primarily fibrotic? Is it a combination of the two? And along with the interstitium, what other structures or compartments might be involved? Because that gets us thinking about other specific etiologies for the ILD.
That's awesome. My head's spinning. That's a lot of anatomy. And you're on top of that anatomy.
It's like throwing up a pathology slide. That'll lose an audience really
quickly. I think we've gone down to zero listeners at this point. Let's pick it up a notch. So that's great. We know where the interstitium is. So let's talk about, you know, I was taught there's over 200 or 300 different types of interstitial lung disease. And if you say that these days in an ILD clinic, someone's going to throw something at you. So, I mean, there's a lot of interstitial lung diseases. So how do you put them into buckets? How do you classify them?
Yeah.
Because I do think the classification helps me and others remember what the causes are or maybe even how to treat them. So how do you put them into, what kind of buckets do you put them into classify these?
So the way that we tend to think about them is really in three buckets. I would say maybe three and a half. And the three buckets would be exposures. And this is where the over 200 number comes up. So inhalation of organic antigens, you know, what I like to call mold, mildew, birds, bacteria category. So in a susceptible individual who repeatedly inhales organic particulates, like, I mean, the classic example is bird protein, but whether it's in the context of a job or a hobby, if you're inhaling typically organic stuff repeatedly over time, it can, in a susceptible individual, lead to inflammation and even progressive, really wicked fibrosis in an individual. But it's not just organic matter, it's various dusts, you know, metal dusts, asbestos, coal, silica, cobalt, medications we put into that category. And the classic example of medication-induced interstitial lung disease is, you know, chemotherapeutic drugs, but amiodarone, you know, we see our fair share of nitrofurantoin or macrobid, macrodantin in those people who use it chronically. So that's the exposures category. And I guess I would make sure that we also understand that cigarette smoke and vaping would also fall into that exposure category. You know, cigarette smoke doesn't just cause emphysema. We know that it can lead to significant inflammation and even fibrosis in the context of interstitial disease. So we have our exposures bucket. The next big bucket would be systemic autoimmune disease. And, you know, the three most common are rheumatoid arthritis, systemic sclerosis or scleroderma, and dermatopolymyositis. But any systemic autoimmune disease can do it. You know, we're learning, we think now probably psoriatic arthritis can do it. Inflammatory bowel diseases can cause interstitial lung disease. So almost any systemic autoimmune disease can do it. And then the third category is idiopathic, right? The dumb doctors need to come up with some name for it. We can't just shrug our shoulders at our patients and say, we don't know. We got to call it something. So we call it idiopathic. And then I said there was kind of a half category. I put familial predisposition. So there are those families that we have where we see numerous, at least two, but often numerous family members who develop various forms of interstitial lung disease. And in many of those families, we can identify a genetic predisposing factor. So exposures, systemic autoimmunity, the idiopathic category, and then that familial or genetic category.
That's how I classify them too. And I often tell patients and even other providers this, that what we do when they come to the clinic, we're like detectives. Our job is to try to find out where they fit. There's a lot we do for that. I mean, if they come in, there's a bird on their shoulder and the bird's, you know, then bird fancier's lung is raises its way on the differential. But we try to figure out which one it is because, again, this, as we talked about earlier, this determines how we treat the patient, right? I mean, how they're going to do and how we treat them.
I think we find ourselves, and it's really important, to ask the questions, right? So to be part of that being a detective is you really got to dig into what jobs they've done over the years, where they've lived over the years, what their home environment is like, what hobbies they like to do. And are there any red flags that would make us think, this exposure in the context of whatever, this hobby or this job, could actually be the thing that's driving it. And you don't know unless you ask. And it takes a good long while to really dig down into a really good history.
And for those who don't see these patients on a regular basis, there are questionnaires you can use. I know ACCP used to have one online, but asking these questions about, do you have a humidifier? Do you have a hot tub? it's hard to remember them all. And in the era of the EMR, a nice way to do it is to have a questionnaire that they fill out before they come see you, an exposure questionnaire. You can even do connective tissue disease review of systems, right? You have to remember, do you have dry mouth or dry eyes? Do you have Raynaud's phenomenon, right? Do you have joint stiffness? So it is hard to remember all this, especially again, if you're not doing this regularly. So if you want to evaluate and find these patients, you have to do that detective work. These 15-minute appointments sometimes that they're giving us just don't cut it, right? I mean, you need to spend some time asking questions. And don't forget to ask about down. There's always down in the house, and down is one. Duvet lung is one that we kind of miss. All right. That's exciting. We can talk about that all day. But let's get some useful information for people who are in the clinic. So how do these patients present? So how do they walk, when they walk in the door, what is a common presentation for interstitial lung disease? And what kind of red flags put that higher up on our differential?
Yeah. You know, when you step back and you think about how patients typically present, and then you think about the different diagnoses get thrown at people, you know, it's incongruent. So the most typical presentation is insidious onset of exertional dyspnea, plus minus cough, plus minus low energy fatigue, right? If you and I had a nickel for every time a patient came in and said, you know what, I'm short of breath. I thought I was just getting old. I thought I was just out of shape. Haven't been exercising a bunch, right? We would own whatever, half of Maui. That is just classic. And so that doesn't sound at all like community acquired pneumonia. That doesn't sound at all like classic asthma. That doesn't sound at all like typical heart failure. I'm not saying that it can't possibly be those things, but you know, when a patient comes in with that presentation, we say, oh, wow, well, this sounds like pneumonia, but they haven't had fever, they don't have chest pain, they don't have cough and sputum. You know, we got to think outside the more typical or more common conditions. But far and away, those are the most common. And I would say we need to be on the lookout for those buckets of causes. So, you know, if somebody's coming in also with joint pain or red hot swollen joints or color changes in the fingers or skin changes, we want to find out about that and ask about that. But it's not the most common presentation among all comers with ILD.
Yeah, I'm taking that very painful ABIM. You have to answer those questions online in internal medicine. It makes me look for the highest bridge. But I'll tell you that whenever I see it, they often present a case of a 60-year-old coming in breathless. And I'm always like, this is ILD. I'm looking for ILD. It's not even on the list. The point is that, yes, in a primary care setting, you are correct. If you come in as a 60-year-old male smoker and you are breathless, right, ILD is not top of that list. It's on that list. But heart disease, COPD, and in general, our patients, by the time they come to us at a referral center, they have bounced around in the community. And there's a big delay. I mean, they used to say 6 to 18 months. That may be a little shorter, but they're appropriately so. They're looking for obstructive coronary disease. They're right. Looking for smoking-related lung disease. And so
yeah,
there are other things I agree that are higher on that list, but this needs to be on the list. And what I would say is a physical exam is great. Crackles are never normal. We still see patients who crackles are noted on exam, and I think there's still a thought, well, some crackles in an older population is normal. Crackles are not normal. When you hear that crackle, however you want to define it, that tells you, right? That next step from there should be imaging, PFTs, or a referral. So I think keeping that on your differential and thinking about the other things that raise it up higher on the differential is great. The most typical thing we see, right, is, I mean, IPF is one of the most common things we see. This is a disease of aging. This is that male predominant in their 60s, smoker, ex-smoker walking in with breathlessness. And I think when you see something that's a little more typical, again, it raises up on your differential, but it's still not number one, right? I mean, there's other right. Heart disease probably would be more common.
Yeah, exactly right. I certainly didn't intend to throw any primary care doc or anybody on the front lines who's seeing this patient present initially under, not trying to throw anybody under the bus. Absolutely. If there is a hint or a possibility that this is cardiac ischemia, then by all means, that needs to be worked up first. I think the point is, if a diagnosis is made and maybe a therapeutic intervention is started and a patient is not responding the way that you would expect them to respond to yeah. whatever that therapy is, then get back to the drawing board quick, broaden your differential, and think about other potential etiologies.
Yeah, I love it. All right. So let's take them down this path. So someone walks in your clinic, they have an insidious onset of breathlessness, they have a dry cough, you hear crackles when you listen to them, or at least ILD, you want to look for ILD, you think it's there based on your clinical judgment and or crackles, what's the first thing they should do? I mean, right, if you're in a primary care setting, should they get a CT, should they get PFTs, or should they try to get that patient referred to a tertiary referral center? I know this will be dependent on the location, but what should be their next step?
Right. How that proceeds will depend on where a person is practicing. We've both sat in focus groups with primary care docs who might be in rural places. And they're like, we don't have a pulmonologist. You know, I can't get a CAT scan, a high resolution CT scan quickly by any stretch. And so the first, in my opinion, you order a high resolution CT scan of the chest. I mean, a standard chest x-ray, when you're really suspicious about interstitial lung disease, a standard chest radiograph, two view, good chest x-ray, still isn't going to show you anything that you need to see. So a high resolution chest CT scan, there's no reason you can't order that. Order PFTs while you're also referring them to pulmonology. Because as you mentioned, you need to have somebody do the detective work, ask the right questions, interpret the CT scan appropriately so that you can make a confident diagnosis and then start the therapy. But I see no reason why a primary care doc, you hear crackles, you've ruled out more common causes either by history or other examinations, order that high resolution CT scan, order PFTs, and then get them to a pulmonologist.
We are seeing so many CT scans done this day, right? I mean, if you walk in an emergency department and you trip and fall, they're going to rule out a pulmonary embolism. You're getting a CT angio. We're finding a lot of these early, but scans are easy to come by. This is a non-contrast scan. So if you're looking at, unless you're worried about a pulmonary embolism, non-contrast CT, and yes, the pulmonary, I agree. Pulmonary function tests are nice to get also, but that's not going to be your primary rule it in or rule it out. Get your scan. Right. If you send them to a pulmonologist or even a tertiary referral center, the first thing they're going to do is say, all right, I think you have this. Let's get a scan. So sending them that would be great. This idea of referral to a tertiary referral center, I mean, that's a big burden on patients. Do you think there's a benefit to having a patient if you establish, hey, CT's abnormal, you have interstitial lung disease, do you think it's beneficial to get them in a tertiary referral center, even if it's a long drive or a flight for patients? Because it is a burden on our patients.
Yeah, it is a burden, but I think, obviously, we're very biased here, but I think it's well worth it. At a minimum, as an initial evaluation or to sort of solidify the diagnosis, to educate about the condition, to educate the patient and probably potentially the provider as well, and maybe you start a therapeutic intervention. But I think having that expertise at a so-called center of excellence or a tertiary referral center is, I think, key. And actually, there's data to suggest that there are better outcomes when patients are seen and followed at tertiary referral centers. I think having that expertise, you know, if there are pathological specimens, having the radiological expertise, being able to sit in the same room with your pathologist and radiologist and present the clinical information while integrating the pathology and the radiological information is key to making a confident diagnosis. And you can only make confident therapeutic decisions if you have that first, you know, confident diagnosis made. So absolutely self-promoting, but I think these patients ideally would be seen at a tertiary referral center.
Yeah, I agree in the same vein as you that it is self-serving. But in addition to that, there's a lot of clinical trials going on in this disease. I want to talk briefly about the treatments in general, but let's talk about there used to be a lot of nihilism with interstitial lung disease. And I think there still is. I think there's a lot of providers in the community, some that say, well, you have IPF, the drugs really just kind of make you sick. You're going to get your affairs in order. I'll see you next year.
Right.
I think there's a lot of hope in this area. We have drugs that are coming. We have drugs available. We have new ones coming out. Getting them to that tertiary referral center and giving them the option of participating in a trial for a new and exciting drug is also a benefit, I think. But there's still resources. There's still a lot of these patients that are managed in a primary care setting, which is fine. There are treatments. Let's talk briefly about that. I mean, I think we're going to have a separate podcast. We're going into the finer details about this. But in general, we do have treatments that are effective that can slow progression of disease. So can we just give them a brief overview of the classes of drugs that we have?
Yeah. And it comes back to that confident diagnosis and either knowing or having a pretty good sense of whether there is an inflammatory component there, how much inflammation might be present, and how much fibrosis is present. In general, we love inflammation because, in general, we think inflammation will respond favorably to immune suppression or immune modulation. So get rid of inflammation by suppressing the immune system. And really what we're doing, I mean, it's probably best called anti-lymphocyte therapy, right? This inflammation that we're talking about is not neutrophilic inflammation. This is chronic lymphocytic inflammation. And the drugs that we would use would be targeting lymphocytes, get rid of lymphocytes, prevent them from coming into the lungs and causing problems. So that big category would be anti-inflammatories, but we use those terms, immune suppression, immune modulation. In general, we're targeting pathways that lymphocytes use for their activity, proliferation, and so forth. And then there is the fibrotic pathways. So using medicines to try to prevent progression of fibrosis. You know, there is this phrase that we use, the profibrotic cascade. So when alveoli get injured, they release what I call evil humors into the surrounding area and the blood. And we want to block those pathways that ultimately lead to the deposition of collagen, fibrosis within the lungs. And sometimes we use those two things in unison, right? Within the same patient, we might use immune modulation, immune suppression, and also an antifibrotic. Again, it depends on the diagnosis. It depends on disease behavior, depends on comorbid conditions present, and a whole bunch of other factors that brings us back to, well, these centers of excellence or tertiary referral centers have more experience in making those decisions and using those medications.
Yeah, and we sit in a room every week, as Jeff alluded to, this sit in a room with our pathologists and our radiologists and sometimes our rheumatologists and debate and discuss what the diagnosis is, but maybe more importantly, what we're going to use to treat these patients. And it is difficult. Sometimes there's not a right answer. Sometimes we try one and try the other. But these are complex decisions. But I kind of want to end on the fact that there is hope for these patients. I know that before 2014, we didn't have any of these antifibrotic drugs. So if you had a progressive fibrotic disease, interstitial lung disease, we threw a bunch of stuff at you. And sometimes the things that we threw at you hurt you. But in 2014, we had two drugs that are FDA approved. And now we've had a third one and potentially a fourth one's coming. So, and these drugs do slow progression. So I just want to say there's a lot of hope in this field. There's a lot going on.
Right. There's been a lot of progress over a pretty short period of time. When I was a fellow, you know, we were doing trials in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, but the talk was, oh, you'll never recruit 300 patients into a trial. Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is just so rare. I don't care how many centers you have around the world, you're never going to be able to enroll 300 patients. And now we're enrolling, you know, 1,100 patients in every one of our trials. And as you mentioned, we get contacted all the time about new drugs coming down the pike, phase one and phase two drugs, soon to be phase three. It's an exciting time to be in the field. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of hope and a lot of enthusiasm. And I think those drugs that you mentioned that were approved in 2014 kind of paved the way, kind of showed the field and showed various pharmaceutical companies, hey, we have drugs that potentially work on these various pathways, or we have a new drug that we think is going to be effective in this disease. Those two companies did it. We can do it too. If you know, you have thoughtful design of your trials, I think the patients are there. The patients are willing to participate. And it's, like you said, it's really an exciting time. And now is the time to be hopeful and not so nihilistic, for sure.
Agreed. I want to close on the fact that there are resources. Say you can't, or you don't know where the tertiary referral centers are, or you can't get your patients there. The Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, I'm going to put a plug for them. They're great. They have a great website that tells you about trials and centers. Places like National Jewish, these centers often have a line that you can call and talk to a doctor to kind of get an interstitial lung disease doc. So you're not alone in dealing with these patients. They're confusing. They're difficult sometimes. We can all together have an impact on them. So yeah, there's resources out there for you.
Absolutely. I think the folks at tertiary referral centers are, I mean, I'll speak for everyone, generally willing and want to help the docs out in the community to make these diagnoses, to feel comfortable prescribing these medications, you know, to be confident in their diagnoses. And so I think all of us working together on our patients' teams is a really good approach.
Yeah, love it. And we're dorks. We're ILD dorks. We will, you want to talk, you can call me at 8 p.m. I'll talk about ILD all night. I love it. My friends who don't do this laugh at me, but I think we're really passionate about this. This is all we do. So use your resources. Great. That was a great conversation. We could talk for hours, but we're going to end it here. This should be a nice overview of interstitial lung disease. Our next podcast will be on a little more deeper dive on something called GERD and soiling the lungs. So how the role of reflux in interstitial lung disease, the stomach soiling the lungs. And we're going to have a special guest on for that one. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
Now that doesn't pique their interest. I don't know what will.
I know. If anyone's not asleep by now. Anyways, thanks for joining. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.